Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We are thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Paul Kruchowski. Paul is a former senior U.S. diplomat and career member of the Senior Executive Service. In his final role at the State Department, he served as the Chief Operating Officer for Public Diplomacy, managing a $1.5 billion budget and 5,000-person global organization. He's a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a graduate of the University of Cincinnati. Outside of his work, Paul is an accomplished cellist. I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show, Paul.
Really glad to be here.
I'm really glad to have you here. I really admired you when I was at the State Department and actually came to you for some advice and guidance at one point because I just looked at you and was like, that guy's doing cool things. Let me see what he can tell me. And you were so generous with your time and you sat down and offered me so many thoughts and a roadmap, and I appreciated that. And so I'm really excited to be able to welcome you to the show now and to let other people benefit from your wisdom.
Yeah, I love talking to people about where they're going. You know, one of the things I have really held myself to over the years is try to help everyone around me be the best version of themselves, right? Whatever that is, and like pull the unique things out of them.
Yeah.
That are going to help them be a great them, right?
Yeah.
Be a great version of themselves.
Yeah. It's like, what is it? The Dr. Seuss saying, today you are you, that is truer than true. There's no one alive who is youer than you. I love that so much. And I think that's exactly what you've done and why you're a phenomenal leader. But before we get to where we're going and where everyone is going, let's go back to where you've been. What sparked your interest in public service? Where did you come from? What was it about your upbringing that led you to pursue this path?
Yeah, so I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. My dad was an Air Force officer. So my early years, I spent a lot of time on Kirtland Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. And then, as you were saying at the opening, I went away and I actually went to music school. I was a cellist. And, you know, by about the end of my first year of music school, I realized that being a concert musician in this day and age is all-consuming. You don't get to do anything else. And I think it was over Thanksgiving break my first year, I was up with some family in Michigan, and one of my family friends said, you know, it's much easier to be a professional diplomat and an amateur cellist than the other way around, right? Like, that seems kind of silly in retrospect, but you know, it's actually a really good insight, right? That there are some things that just consume all of you.
Mm-hmm.
And there was too many things I wanted to do. So I started pursuing different paths. I ended up working at the Human Rights Institute in Cincinnati at the law school there. And then applied on a lark to be a State Department intern.
Interesting.
Thinking that I would hate it and that I would then go do something else, like go travel the world, go to graduate school abroad. But I loved it. I loved the people that I worked with. State had a reputation at that time as being kind of a stuffy institution that was kind of slow moving, you know, the old adage, 21st century problems, 20th century structured, 19th century tools. I remember the day that they sent out the department notice that we were closing the cable office.
Oh my gosh.
There was a physical place where we could go and pick up cables.
When was this? Like around what year?
That was 2009, like not that long ago. You have that stuff, but it was just the most incredible workplace, right? With smart people, kind people, working on really hard problems and willing to think about them in new ways. And, you know, at the end of my internship, they asked if I would stay as a paid intern, which was something you could do then, this kind of stay on.
Yeah.
So I did. And then I was,
that's wonderful.
I found a job after that and then just kind of kept going from problem set to problem set. for
I actually
15
didn't know
years.
that they used to let interns opt to stay on as a paid intern if they were selected, because I talked to so many interns. So I was a State Department intern before I came back and applied for a civil service role and landed that job. And then I ended up talking to a lot of interns because my leaders would send interns my way and say, like, would you be willing to talk to this person? They would love to hear about your path, which was non-traditional. And so many interns loved the work and would do anything to find a way to stay on. And it's so challenging. Yeah. And now more than ever.
This was the programs that existed before what's now Pathways, and that you could basically just make job offers. And like, I'm glad that they have them open and available for people to apply to now. I think that's probably a better system overall because it was really opaque then. I got really lucky, and I think that we often underestimate the role of luck in our own journeys. I got lucky a lot.
I agree. I think it is some timing and some luck, but also putting yourself in all the right places where you have the opportunity to be lucky. So, on that note, so many public servants are now in the job market because of some bad luck, searching for their next opportunities. What advice would you offer based on your own experiences as a manager and just as a person navigating a career?
I mean, you've hit on one of the most important things, which is just go talk to people. Early on in my career, the first time I was thinking about leaving state, and was kind of hunting for a new job inside and outside, I was probably having a coffee meeting with someone every day, if not two a day, just working through getting to know people and what they are working on, not asking for a job, just asking a lot of questions and being curious about the universe. And that's ultimately actually how I found my job that round, is talking to people until we both had a moment of, oh, maybe this is a different conversation than we thought we were having.
Interesting.
And the more people you know, the more people you talk to and express curiosity, the more likely you are to kind of make those connections. So talk to a lot of people. Don't hide at home right now, even though it's really tempting. And then also think about what's important to you and all of the ways that your experience translates. So particularly in government, we tend to manage larger organizations and budgets than our peers at comparable levels of seniority. You know, it's not rare for someone with 10 years of experience at the State Department to manage $1.5 billion, which is insane when you consider that in kind of a private sector context. And we're also often in state and the foreign affairs agencies often operating with a lot of risk and a lot of uncertainty. You know, doing programming in Chad is really complicated. You have to manage security, you have to manage another regulatory environment. You're often dealing with a lot of US regulation too, where we in the US government are highly regulated, right? There are a lot of rules about how we do things. And those skills translate really well to the private sector. Finance and banking, healthcare, are all highly regulated sectors where the ability to think about how you get work done at a good cost with a lot of regulation matters a lot. So a lot of the skills we have translate well. And then the kind of last piece of advice will not apply to everyone, but really think about getting beyond Washington, right? Because there are so many good organizations out there that need help and that often have real public good and public benefit to them, but they're not here. And I think one of the real challenges with kind of the current job market is so many of the terminations are disproportionately located here that it becomes really, really challenging when this labor market is just as flooded as it is. And not everyone can move. Like, I can't move. I'm going to stay here for a while because I have kids in school and everything else. But if you have that flexibility, think about where else you might find another adventure and then come back here in a few years.
Yeah, and state and local government too, like, is an awesome place to look for opportunities. And I think they would be really excited to see people with federal experience coming in and offering those experiences.
Absolutely.
When we talked earlier, we talked about understanding what's in your control and adapting and recognizing that,
Oh,
like,
yeah.
just because all of the programs that you worked on may not be going forward, it doesn't mean that, like, your work was meaningless. Tell me about the amazing analogy you came up with for that, because I think our listeners deserve to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, so this
Also, it's
is,
summer and it has a summer vibe, so
yeah,
please.
no, absolutely. So I've talked for a really long time about work in the federal space as kind of like building sandcastles on a beach, right? Which is there are things you control and things you don't. And there are also phenomena that are so big that even if you want to fight them, you can't, right? Anyone tried to fight a wave? Everyone has tried to fight a wave as a kid. The ocean always wins. You can decide where you build your sandcastle, but eventually, a tide may be high enough that it comes in and sweeps away what you've done. It doesn't mean you haven't created something beautiful. It doesn't mean that that beautiful thing hasn't had a real and meaningful impact on the people who have seen it and experienced it. But it may be time bound. It may be of kind of a temporary nature. And that's not necessarily bad. I think one of the things that we all have to get comfortable with in our lives is being zen about the fact that sometimes the ocean sweeps away things that were beautiful. And we all know how to build new sandcastles. We have learned and practiced that skill, and if you've done it once, you can do it again. And the programs that we all have done, the impact that you have on other people doesn't go away. It may change, and new things may happen, but it doesn't go away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you saw this yet, because I think it just came out today, but a whole bunch of atrocity prevention professionals who are former US government decided to get together now that they're outside government and actually, like, write a shadow report to Congress on atrocity prevention, basically mirroring the work that they were doing inside government and that would typically be undertaken by the government at this time. They're really modeling, like, feeling that the sandcastle is still worthy and being willing to build it kind of regardless of the environmental factors. And I think that's a great example to people who still feel invested in their mission, in the work that they were doing, that you can still choose to invest in that work and find other ways to get your message out there. And it doesn't have to end just because the pathway has diverted.
Yeah, and I think particularly for folks at state. So one of the projects that I've been working on is trying to help connect people with jobs in the private sector, including people and companies who are interested in fractional or part-time work, right?
Talk
And
about fractional work for a second, because I think it's a term people aren't familiar with.
so say I am a $10 million annual revenue company, right? And I am looking to expand or grow. I need a part-time COO, or I need someone to do operations or global expansion. And normally that would cost me $250,000 or more to hire someone. I don't have that in my budget. I need to do it, but I don't have the budget, and I probably don't have full-time work for someone. So in kind of the old world, you might hire someone part-time as kind of a part-time laborer, or on contract. But what's been happening more and more for a lot of these particularly strategic roles is they hire someone on a contractual basis for 8 to 10 hours a week that they acknowledge is doing business with the same function with a number of other companies. So a chief financial officer who works for five or six different companies at once, giving them each a little bit of time. And what that allows the company to benefit from is someone who works at a higher level. They only need a little bit, but also someone who carries a lot of insights from other places. And I,
Like, think of
right?
the cross-pollination. Like, that's
Exactly.
amazing.
So
Super cool.
it's a model that particularly in kind of the small and medium-sized organizations has become more and more regular because it's economically efficient for them. It allows people to have a lot of flexibility, and particularly in a remote work environment, it's really easy to slot people into a new organization and bring their expertise in along the way. And if you think about the work we've done at State, We often are already in that mindset, right? We
Right.
work on multiple projects and accounts in multiple ways.
Yep.
You may be, as a commercial officer, working with Boeing over here and then going and advocating for someone else over here. We already have that mindset ready to go. And with the downsizing of the State Department and other offices, like, there is actually a gap here that I think a lot of our colleagues coming out of state are actually really well suited to fill, because they've done many of those jobs before already. It
Yeah,
just
for sure.
changes how it's going to get done.
Yeah, and as an individual, then you're able to like create your own robust learning environment and take on projects that enrich you and also maybe scale up and scale down based on what the demands of your personal life are at that moment.
Exactly.
Super cool. I hope that that was helpful to people. It was helpful to me to hear about
Yeah.
it. And so that actually leads us right into the question I wanted to ask you next about work-life balance and work-life
Yeah.
integration, which is a topic that we covered when we were planning for this call. And
Yeah.
first, I want to ask you, is it a struggle for you?
So I think I am integrated. I'm not sure I'm balanced, because I'm a chronic overcommitter. I am always doing more things than I frankly have capacity to do.
Why
But
do you think that is?
because there's too much interesting stuff to do. I'm curious about the world. Fractional work, content creation, project-based consulting all interest me. Why not do all of them at once? Just why not? And I was that way when I was in government. I was that way when I'm out of government, and I realized that's probably just me. And part of the challenge is, like, knowing how much of this is your environment and how much of this is you, and how those shape each other. I create that for myself. But I also know what matters to me, right? So for the time that I was at State, the last 6, 7 years, I did both my kid pick up and drop off every day, which meant that I wasn't in the office as many hours as other people were. But I often worked first thing in the morning before they were up, spent some time, dropped them off, worked 6, 7 hours in the office, picked them up, worked a little bit more in the evening. And that worked for me, right?
And for your family.
Mostly worked for my family. But I think that that's that kind of dialogue about what works for you, what works for others, is kind of part of what integration is continuing to figure out where you make compromises that get everything you want done. Because you're never going to get everything done.
Yeah, that's so true. But then we get into like, okay, so that's integration and we're also getting at multitasking, which is something that we all do kind of constantly these days. And I believe that I'm like you, kind of always looking for many things to inspire me and connecting so many dots and finding that doing a lot of different things does enrich the way that I think about each of those projects. However, multitasking and switching between contexts can also be really challenging and can make it more difficult for me to focus deeply on something. So how do you deal with that challenge?
I know what time of day I focus deeply best. It's the
Okay.
morning for me. I'm worthless most of the time in the afternoon. That's a great time for me to do meetings, to switch tasks, to do other things, because my attention span is just lower then. Knowing yourself is a really big part of that. One of the things that's helped more than anything else in the last couple of years is, as soon as I think of something distracting, I dump it down into one of two places, and then I put it out of my mind. So we started using, in my old office, we started using Asana, which is a task management platform. We all used it. Any time that I thought of something that needed to be done, I wrote it down. If it was for me, I assigned it to myself, gave it a date, and then left it alone. And then if it's content, I have a couple of documents that I dump things into so that I can get them out of my mind and go back to focusing. I
This is
also
why
spent.
my desktop is littered with post-its, like sticky notes everywhere.
I used to do that, and then I found that I was losing things,
I don't think it's the best
particularly.
system.
And part of what I liked about Asana that was kind of a real revelation for me last year, 2 years ago, was It is shared. And I think one of the problems that we have when we work with other people and figure out how to collaborate is you use Google Keep, I use Asana, someone else writes emails to each other. And so there actually isn't any harmonizing language there. And that actually makes it much harder to figure out how you work with other people and dump everything from all of your brains into a place where you can kind of get a lay of the land together.
I love that. And now I'm going to look into it. Maybe this episode can be sponsored by Asana. So in order to create, like, you're talking about organization and getting everybody organized and on the same team. How, as a leader, did you try to foster like good and healthy organizations?
I think a lot about this in terms of process people goals. The good organizations have common goals, and you have to be able to articulate them. And if I ask you what our three goals are, if you and I have different answers, we've made a mistake because you have to be aligned. I am a little bit of a organizational goal cultist in that I always keep a slide up. If you talk to people in my former office, everyone knows what the five things we were working on this year were. Everyone. And they know which of them they are contributing to. So that's one part of it is you have to have a common idea about where you're going together. You have to take care of each other. And my kind of trinity of these things are every manager needs to have a one-on-one with every person that reports to them every week. You have to have a one-on-one touch base. You have to have meaningful performance conversations and individual performance goals that are linked to the organizational goals. They have to be linked. That seems silly. They're often not, right? And when you have someone who's like a customer service representative and their goal is close out tickets, if closing out tickets is not represented in the organizational goal, like they're just building widgets off in a corner. And that becomes a problem. But at state and in a lot of other federal agencies, there isn't a connection there.
And that is actually where like inefficiencies come from.
And then the third is they actually have to have a really clear idea about what their role is, right? R role clarity, goal clarity, and a meaningful relationship with their supervisor. Gallup also points out something that I think is really, really important now in the work that they do, which is good organizations are one where everyone has a best friend at work. And it is amazing how much pushback I get from people about this. But healthy organizations are where people actually know each other and
And
know
where
each other as
you spend a
humans.
lot of your time at work. So like hopefully you do have meaningful relationships, but I know it's not always the case, but then that also comes back to culture. Like how do you create a culture where there is psychological safety and where there's trust? And like with the one-on-ones that you were talking about, I was thinking about the role of having those regular touch points in building trust so that people can come to you with culture issues that are affecting their work and performance.
And you know, good one-on-ones are employee driven, they're not manager driven. They are coaching first and foremost. Here's what I'm working on, and here's the help I need. Here are the places where I'm stuck or where I need to resolve problems. Then feedback, and then information delivery, right? And most people think about it as information delivery first, and then maybe manager feedback to the employee and then coaching. And that's entirely backward, right? You want employee driven and problem focused because that's to your point, that also builds a degree of psychological safety when you can start to do things together and understand each other as humans, how you're thinking about it, where things are causing problems, and maybe get some advice on where some approaches may not be the best ones along
And
the way.
like clarity is kindness, consistency is kindness. Even if you have to deliver hard feedback, I think in a safe environment like that, people can be more receptive as well. So what is your advice for perfectionists? Because I think we're talking right now about like creating organizations where people can be high achievers and they can like do their best work, but also perfectionism can be more of a hindrance sometimes than a help. What's your advice there?
Yeah, I mean, in every organization, you have things that need an A plus job and things that don't. We have all worked on that paper where good enough is in fact good enough. And one of the hardest things for I think all of us is to realize, like, you do that slide deck, you spend 90 hours on it, it gets looked at for 5 minutes, and you're really frustrated about that. Why did you spend 90 hours on it is the like core problem. And doing a B plus job is often good enough. And a B plus job maybe takes you half the time of getting it to an A or an A plus. And like figuring out how to discern that as an individual is really important. As a manager, I often told our folks, like, this is something you can do a B plus job on, right? Preparing me for meetings where I know the substance. Do a B minus job. Spend 5 minutes on it. I just need the basics. And being able to have that language and then also feel comfortable defining success and defining perfection as getting the right level of effort and doing no more is, I think, can actually be very freeing for a lot of people.
It can. And I think if you can't totally eradicate your perfectionist tendencies, then you can apply perfectionism to, and I'm only saying this maybe to, like, I'm speaking to myself right now. If you can't get rid of your perfectionist tendencies, you can apply that perfectionism to the project of being really good with your time. And so understanding, like, where does this task fit when contextualized among all my other tasks? And I'm going to be like ruthless with myself about not letting myself get obsessed with this one because it's actually below three other things. That's something that I'm like always working on. And I think this is why I relate so much to perfectionists, but I think I'm not one, but I actually am.
Define good standards of success for yourself. And so sometimes the standard is no wasted effort, right? Spending no more effort than you actually need to spend.
But you also have to be clear with others on what kind of a job will suffice because, like, I'm thinking of painting, okay? When my husband and I decide to paint a room, we have very different ideas about what's good enough. I'm like, let's get it done as fast as possible, and then I can do another room. And he's like, there's paint everywhere. That's not okay. And so have to be clear on what's acceptable as well. all right, so moving on, because I really want to get to this point, because I think our listeners might be wondering, what factored into your decision to leave the State Department, and how did you think through and work through that process and arrive to where you are now?
So we're going to tell this story chronologically backward. I left state on June 14th. I knew probably by mid-March that it was time for me to go. But probably for different reasons than a lot of people expect. I ended up leaving because I thought that I was about to do all of the good that I could do in the job that I was in. And that if I stayed, I probably was not going to do significantly more big stuff or learn significantly more than I had already. I'd been in my job for a really long time by the standards of state. So I'd been in that job for about 4 years. I had been in that office for nine. And when I had walked in the door the day before the 2016 election, I had a list of five or six things that I wanted to get done. And by February, it was really clear that the last two that I had on that list that was 9 years old, I was get were going to be done in 2025. And I could do additional things. I could look for another job internally. But as I looked around me, that was not going to be the thing. There wasn't a job that I was really excited about growing into next, or that I thought was going to be the right sort of challenge for what I needed to do as an individual next. So I started thinking about, okay, how do I leave the team with what they need to be successful? Help think about transition and succession planning, help make sure that all of those things were on track to get done, that I wasn't going to drop too many balls in the process of getting out. And then start to think about what it could be for me next. And I feel really good, a month and a half after that with the set of choices I made. In large part because I was not running away from something. I had almost left this job 2 years before that, but it was because I had gotten really frustrated with some of the people I worked with. And some of I was functionally running away from problems or thinking about running away from them. And I got all the way to doing job interviews and really seriously pursuing outside opportunities then. And then I kind of stopped myself and said, what am I doing and am I going to regret it? And I stopped, took some vacation, and then came back and said, no, it's time to keep going and keep doing this
Yeah, it wasn't
because
the moment.
I'm not done. And I think when I came back to that 2 years later, I was able to say, you know, now is actually the time. And the thing that I've told a number of people when they asked me this question, in short, is it was time. It was time to move on and do something else.
And to be able to do it on your terms and do it the way you wanted to do it. And that makes sense too, because like I feel like that's aligned with what little I've been able to like gain in the short time of your personality. You're a very organized, intentional person. And so I feel like it seems like you reached the point where you're like, now the law of diminishing returns applies. Like now it's time for me to move on. And that makes sense. And I'm glad that you were able to do that in the way that you wanted to and in a way that was really thoughtful and structured.
It was a gift. I was really fortunate that I had the option to do it the way that I wanted to in an environment where a lot of people didn't get that choice. My chief of staff would tell you that I'm the most chaotic person in the world. I may be intentional, but there is no order. There is
Maybe it's
only chaos.
intentional chaos. All right. So then, Paul, last question for now. What is your greatest hope for the future? And please take this wherever you want.
I think that this is a moment in time where a lot of people across the political spectrum, across the country, are really down on the future prospects of the United States and us and individuals in it. And I am not quite so. I think there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about where we are in this moment, whether it's pieces of the economy, whether it's kind of geopolitical factors or something else. But a perpetual reminder that I have about the American experiment is nothing in the United States was ever guaranteed. We were not guaranteed to be independent. We were not guaranteed to be a superpower. We were not guaranteed to make it through, you know, the Civil War and the conflicts of the 19th century. Nothing we had was guaranteed. It was because Americans looked at the problems, looked at the challenges, and figured out ways to work together and sometimes muddle through, sometimes end up on breakaway tears. And I still see the same things that have made us successful in the past in my fellow citizenry here. And I think that that offers a whole range of promises for the future. I don't think that the way the as kind of a longtime PD person, I think we all need to step away from the media and the internet and go touch grass for a little bit. Because the media ecosystem right now is not particularly conducive to our own psychological health. Social media is absolutely damaging. And spend some time actually out in community with other people and figure out how you organize for better pieces of the future. Because I think they're out there, whether it's the news about the incredible jump in solar production in California this year, which if people have not gone and read about, it's truly astounding. Whether it's looking at some of the incredible potential biotech and other technologies that are out there that have incredible opportunities to change what human well-being is, there's a lot that is good. And it's really a question of whether we have the psychological endurance and willpower to decide that we are going to bend the arc of that towards the light or not. And I think we will. I
We
think
keep
we
talking
will.
about bending the arc on this show. It just keeps coming up with public servants. I can't imagine why. But I feel the same way as you. I actually feel remarkably optimistic, maybe more than I have in years, because I'm doing this project and I'm getting to talk to public servants every day. And if you really want to be inspired, like go talk to a public servant. And that's like I also think in terms of social media, totally agree with you that like it can be completely toxic and terrible for mental health. And I think if we emphasized more on the social, less on the media, that'd be great because it can also be a powerful engine for connecting people with one another and creating opportunities and new little thought babies. And so I'm really happy to be connected with you, to be able to hear your story and share your story with others. And I also just want to take this opportunity to thank you so much for your many years of service to our country, Paul.
Very kind, and I'm hoping that I will have many more years yet to come.
I hope so too. Thanks so much.
Okay.